Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, my name's Jess Phillips, and welcome back to Yours Sincerely. Now, most of you might know, I'm an MP in Birmingham, but what you might not know is that I've always been a prolific letter writer and know the power of putting words to paper. So, in this podcast, I give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Lisa Nandy is the Labour MP for Wigan and the Shadow Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing, Communities and Local Government. She has been a Member of Parliament for nearly 13 years, spending much of that time on the front bench. Before entering Parliament, Lisa worked for the youth homelessness charity Centrepoint and the Children's Society. Today I'm excited to talk to her about the letters she would send to three people who mean the world to her. So hello, Lisa. This is funny because we were at work together yesterday and we'll be at work together after this as well. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, you might be. I'm going home, actually.
Oh, are you?
Well, I'm going up north because of the rail strike and childcare. A combination of the two things mean that I'm driving.
Right, and yeah, I've got my car here.
I might as well get a camel, to be honest. The whole thing's just a disaster.
Oh, it absolutely is a disaster, although I've been driving loads more because regardless of the rail strike, those of us, as I'm sure you do, relying on Avanti. Avanti gets a lot of mentions on this podcast about how shit it is.
Good.
It is the shittest of shit. So
I don't know, you know, TransPennine is up there rivaling Avanti at the moment.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, there's a huge... You know, the Tories always say they want competition on the railways.
Yeah.
Well, they've got it, haven't they? They're all competing for who can be the worst provider.
It is so bad at the moment. I don't notice when there's a strike anymore. I literally can't tell the difference.
I honestly think it's worse on some non-strike days than it is on strike days.
Oh, 100%. Days. It's worse. At least I know on a strike day that I have to take my car. Do you know what I mean? I can plan. They give you forewarning on a strike day. On every other day, thank God that the last Labour government did up New Street Station, because I have spent something like 7 hours a week there waiting for the level of productivity that must be affected by...
Well, this is actually how I ended up writing a book, because I spent so much time sitting at Crewe railway station in the middle of the night waiting for a train that clearly wasn't coming that I decided to write a book on my phone.
Why
in the waiting room.
Why do I always still hope? I sit there.
It's the hope that kills you.
It's the hope that kills you. The total triumph of hope over experience. I sit there going, I bet the next one will be fine.
Yeah.
It's never fine.
Yeah.
It's never been fine.
Well, this is partly what I think accounts for the general sense of just frustration, anger, whatever you want to call it, out in the country. Because if you leave people standing at a bus stop for a decade, people are going to get angry.
I mean, you would, wouldn't you? You're just like,
I'm livid,
oh, Jesus.
Personally.
So now, I often say, this is all about letter writing, and I often say that because actually 99% of people don't write letters anymore. But in our profession, we are avid letter writers. I often talk as well about the parliamentary currency of a handwritten note. There is, you know, the way people send handwritten notes.
I don't do that either,
Lisa.
I think it's kind of weird, actually.
When you get those handwritten notes.
It's very charming when it's somebody, you know, in the House of Lords.
Yeah.
Who's been in government or something, you know, a long time ago and sends you a note saying, I'm very encouraged by something you've said.
Yeah.
Something. That's very nice. But when it's people our age, I just think, well, you wouldn't normally do that.
But people do it when they want to be elected to exactly. to be on something.
Oh, do you know, I was skirting around it because I didn't want to get flack from my colleagues.
The handwritten note is because people want to be elected to be the chair of something or something.
It's when people have clearly looked up the names of your children and have inserted them in the relevant space into this note and you just think, don't bother, I'm voting for someone else.
Have you got any letters that you kept? The person who I just interviewed before you had one from George Bush Senior.
What?
Like,
okay, this is what I mean. And now you got me in.
I mean, you must get a Christmas card from Tony Blair. Have you letters
That's
from
not
the
a
Royal...
letter though.
No,
have That's you? That's like a printed signature. Yeah. No? Yeah. Sorry, Tony, if you've actually signed them.
Tony Blair's Christmas card gets more outings on this podcast than ever before. And this year, I've mentioned it so much, and it has been written about in newspapers so much because I've mentioned it so much, that I felt that he would keep me off the Christmas card list this year, but he didn't.
Maybe it's just possible he doesn't listen to this podcast. Maybe when he's thinking about the future of the world and that sort of
well,
thing.
Well, that's
maybe
very rude, Tony Blair.
You should get him on. Get him to talk about his Christmas card. I'm racking my brains here. I'm actually starting to sweat a little bit because I'm thinking I need to now demonstrate to your listeners that I'm extremely well connected. People writing to me from all over the world saying how brilliant
I am. We've had people who've been...
can't think of a single one.
Nelson Mandela we've had. Queen of Norway or somewhere. Did you not get any letters from the royals ever?
No.
You've never read a letter?
I got invited to Clarence House once.
Yeah. And you get the fancy, it comes in a fancy envelope. Yeah.
I enjoyed the envelope, I didn't go. Do you know, there's this thing in Parliament, like it happens to MPs very quickly, where we talk about outside like it's another place.
Yeah.
And we never really leave the building.
Yeah.
I think it is partly a consequence of just being tired all the time.
That, yeah.
You know, you like... Monday was a good example. We voted until midnight.
Yeah.
And then I had a meeting scheduled at why, I don't know, for 8 o'clock in the morning. And so you're just not sleeping at all.
Yeah, I don't sleep at all.
Outside feels like a very difficult thing to do when you're traipsing up and down the corridors.
And Clarence House was just too far away.
It was
away.
Just too far. I mean, you know, I would have loved to go, but it was too far.
You do actually become... like, when you're first elected, you get invited to loads of stuff and you go to it all. And then after the first 6 months, you think, I'm just staying here. I'm just going to eat my dinner in my office with West Streeting and just be done with it.
Yeah, but also, I don't know, I just think Parliament would be so much better if everyone got a bit more sleep.
Yeah.
And I'm really regretting this now because I'm thinking if I'd gone to Clarence House, I could probably sit here and tell you that I'd had a letter from, like, the King.
Yeah.
But I can't because I just stayed in my office and ate my dinner with Wes Streeting. And Nat, I tell you what, actually, I tell you who does write letters, diplomats.
Yeah.
So not all of them. There's a sort of new generation of diplomats.
Foreign Secretary,
and they write you lovely handwritten notes and they send you gifts as well, which is all a bit problematic because obviously you declare everything that you get in Parliament. So I was never quite sure, you know, whether to declare it, whether to send it back, or is that going to cause a war? just never quite sure about it. I once got sent 500 mangoes from Pakistan.
Oh, there's a particular... See, this happens to me very regularly, the mangoes from Pakistan, because Pakistani mangoes are literally the best and sweetest, but it's for literally 1 month
of
the year.
Well, this was the problem. So they got stuck in the parliamentary system.
I can believe
it. You know, everything that comes into Parliament has to get checked and double-checked and all the rest of it. And they ended up stranded at some office somewhere. And by the time I got these mangoes, it was bad.
Yeah.
It was more like a sort of threat than a sort of... Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a man who turns up at my office with
mangoes
from the Pakistani embassy. He just drives them to my office in Birmingham.
Now, the US embassy once sent me a mask of Donald Trump. I did get a Biden one as well. It was a sort of, you know, getting ready for the elections sort of pack. And they sent me a sort of goodie pack for the US elections. And there was this mask of Donald Trump. And my researcher used to wear it to scare me sometimes. Come in the office and see Donald Trump at the desk.
The talking to diplomats, and it reminds me of thinking about the US diplomats and the people who work at the embassy here for the US government. They come into Parliament and just chat with you. But basically, their job is to gossip with politicians in the country that they are in a lot of cases. And I remember the moment, the sort of horrible moment when I realised that everything that I was saying was being sent back. And in 50 years' time, me talking about, like...
Love Island to the person will have been written down, and that is what is going to be like in 50 years time when they release the records, because you've got all these things about, like, you know, the different people talking about bananas and things in that get. I just thought, oh God, I'm going to try and make these meetings more meaningful. I just sit and gossip with them.
Do you remember Margaret Beckett, when the Queen died, telling this story, this amazing story about how, as a young whip on the Labour side, she was tasked with writing to the Queen every week.
Now they go and sit and talk to them.
To give her the gossip.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, imagine if that had been you or me.
I know.
Imagine what a weird, distorted view of things the Queen would have got. This is really problematic. Never do a podcast with your friend.
Because we'll just tell what it's actually like. Obviously, I also sit with the American diplomats and talk very seriously about foreign affairs and the problems in the UK, but also sometimes gossip with them about Love Island. I'm looking forward to reading it, all the stuff that we said. What are they called? What do they call when the dispatches they send? It's called something really specific, you know, when they write it all down.
But you know, there's this really good book called The Naked Diplomat by a guy who used to be one of Britain's leading diplomats. He's now he's at Oxford University doing some stuff. He's a really interesting guy. But he's got this book about how basically diplomacy is completely changing. And now they're all on like social media and they're sort of working, you know, they're doing a sort of PR strategy and all the rest of it. I found it genuinely really fascinating. Like, I don't really think of diplomats like that at all.
No.
But they're not writing letters anymore, Jess. They're all on Twitter.
They're on Twitter. Oh, I'll chat with them some more. Until you're exposed to diplomacy abroad, like when we go anywhere, you go and see the British embassy in that country. And it is like something from a different era, isn't it? Like,
do you know the thing I noticed first of all is where are the women?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a new generation of women coming through who are amazing. This woman called Karen Pierce, who you'd really like. She's from the north of England, from Preston, and she just no nonsense, you know, just like you'd expect.
Yeah.
And like, there's a whole generation of them that are like breaking those glass ceilings. But it's so striking when, you know, I used to work with children and young people before I came into Parliament. And stepping into Parliament from that world was like, you know, where's the diversity gone at all?
Yeah, yeah.
But then stepping into the diplomatic world, it was like, whoa.
It's like something, it's like how you might imagine. It's literally like the ambassador's reception in the advert for Ferrero Rocher.
Yeah, it's like sort of James Bond.
It is.
But without the exciting bits.
Yeah.
You know, the car chases.
You're talking about trade at breakfast in like, I don't know, like East Africa somewhere. And you're eating an English breakfast off a plate using silverware. It's a picture of the Queen. It's so weird. And I thought that was just something from a novel, but it is actually like, you know, like it's got like the royal seal on the butter dish your individual silver butter dish.
There is so much about this job. Like, you write loads of books, don't you? You need when this is over, you need to write a book about it, because it's just so much about this job that it's completely
so weird,
bonkers.
So weird.
Right, sorry. So I've had no letters.
You've had no letters. Nobody likes you enough to write to you. If anyone listening, please write Lisa a letter. Not hate mail. Thanks. One day I am going to bring into this podcast all of the hate mail.
I do actually get plenty of hate mail. Yeah. I should have gone straight there, shouldn't I?
Yeah, that's it. I've got some great hate mail that I've kept over the years. So I've asked you to think about three people that you would want to write a letter to in either celebration or not, if that is your desire. So the first one is the person who means the world to you. So who would you write that letter to?
So I've decided to choose my mum.
Oh, that's a nice choice.
Yeah, isn't it? Well, also it'll curry favour and all. Make sure that she continues to do the bulk of my childcare, without which I couldn't do my job. Partly this is me being a bit subversive, because I was so fed up when I wrote the book, and I don't do a lot of interviews where I talk about myself, because as you'll be finding today, it's a bit like pulling teeth. But every single interviewer said to me, really interested in your granddad, really interested in your dad. And I started noticing how every time I was sort of introduced at things, I remember going on Question Time once and they said her granddad did this, her dad did this, she resigned from Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet and chaired Owen Smith's campaign. Yeah. And I was like, literally, I have done a few things in my life without reference to a man.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was so weird because, you know, occasionally I'd just say to people, you know, I've got a mum as well.
Yeah.
Like, you could ask about her. Because she has actually been by far the biggest influence on my life. Like, I grew up in Manchester in the 1980s with two very loving parents, but in a lone parent household because my parents were divorced. It was at a time when the Tory government were actively attacking single mums. You know, I remember one day she had a fit at me when I'd spilled all my breakfast down. I always spill my coffee, but I still do now. And I was going out the house, about to go to school, looking a complete mess. And she said to me, we can't do that. We've got to have higher standards than that, or we'll attract the attention of the authorities and we'll be in real trouble. And it was that climate that they created and how she navigated all of that. She was a current affairs producer at Granada. She was the only woman in the department. She was head of news when Hillsborough happened. And we were in the newsroom that night for hours, I think about 12 hours, while she ran the newsroom and me and my sister slept under a table because she had no childcare. Yeah. And I don't remember anyone else in that newsroom having to navigate childcare.
Yeah, there was no formalised childcare really until the last Labour government, actually.
I mean, it was insane, actually, like thinking back on it. She was having to make really difficult calls. Like, you know, she was being asked by the ground crew, do we keep filming or do we put our cameras down and go and help people?
Yeah.
Now, that is not a call that I would want to have to make. And actually, she told them to keep filming.
Yeah.
And it became quite important evidence later in that 25-year battle for justice. But, you know, she's having to do that while she's got two kids going, Mum.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I'm hungry, Mum. I haven't eaten for 10 hours.
And, you know, you can't remember this, but you were almost certainly a massive dick about it.
Yeah. Oh, no. Because it's a given. An absolute given.
Kids are.
Yeah.
When you're trying to work and your children are there, they're annoying.
Well, except the iPad does a lot of work now, right?
It does
a lot of the heavy lifting. But 100%. In those days, it was like somebody found us a biro and we'd be trying to draw a picture on
exactly.
a scrap
a
piece
word
of paper.
Search at best. at the very
that was a big day.
I was going to play I Spy. It's like I'm playing I Spy all the way to the south of
by
France.
By myself.
It's like 19 hours.
So it was like, for me, that was really, really important because that generation of women, they were told that they could have it all, but actually they did it all.
Yeah.
And because they did it all, I think for my generation, I read something that Stella Creasy said in an interview a few years ago, where she said, I think our generation dropped the ball on the battle for equality. Yeah. And I don't think that's true of you, and I don't think it's true of her. And genuinely, I found it really inspiring the way that you two will take no prisoners about this and you'll call things out. It's helped me to see a lot more of it that I didn't see before. But I think I grew up really feeling like, you know, I've got two feminist parents. Mm. You know, my dad was involved in the Equal Pay Act, the Race Relations Act. I grew up with, and I came of age when New Labour won. I was 17 in 97. I just think I started to believe that progress is inevitable.
Yeah.
That the arc of history always bends that way. And it doesn't, I've learnt, in the last decade. In fact, it's the other way round.
I feel for our mother's generation, so we're almost exactly the same age. I was 16 when the Labour government came to power. But I think of my mum, and I think Stella has a point, actually, in what she's saying, because like then that same generation with the WASPI women who like, and it's just like, oh my God, they had nothing. And people like my mum fought for there to be organised childcare.
Yeah.
Like, so that women like me, when I had my kids, I had somewhere to send my children. And they had crapper pensions, but they were always fighting. And then we just sort of went, cheers, a little bit. There was a little bit of like, oh, cheers, thanks, I've got childcare for my kids. I mean, not us personally, I think we fight all the time. But I do feel like there was a little bit of complacency because of their success.
But I think I was worse than you because I couldn't see it a lot of the time. I mean, it's partly a consequence of where I was working. Mm. I worked in the housing world for a while, and then I worked for I went for Centrepoint and then the Children's Society, and I was in the charity sector. You get a lot of diversity until you get to the top, then it just falls away,
just like,
and then you've got lots
like
of white men.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So I just think that I didn't really see it. And it was only when I got elected to Parliament and suddenly just got this onslaught of like sexism in the media and, you know, people commenting on what I was wearing. And then suddenly started to realise, you know, we had this thing, do you remember a few years ago where there was we suddenly realised that the select committees were just men.
Yeah.
And there'd never been, like, a female chair of most of the economic select committees. And I think you were one of the people behind it, but, you know, a lot of us decided that's not OK,
yeah,
actually.
Should have organised.
So we're just going to vote for women.
Yeah.
And that's what I do now. I just vote for women.
Yeah.
And do you remember that first time we did it? Nicky Morgan took over the Treasury Committee.
That's right, yeah, that's
first time in Parliament's history. You had Rachel Reeves on Bays. You had Yvette Cooper on Home Affairs, and it was like, oh, we can change this, actually.
Yeah.
We don't have to stand around shouting about it. We could actually just use the power that we've got to do something about it.
Yeah.
And that was, I don't know, I think that example that my mum set to my generation, I feel like our generation is starting to find our voice and start to
think
about
that. It's definitely happened now, and there's been, like, you know, such a massive backlash. But yeah, when I think about the hardships of working women in the 1980s, even though, obviously, the head of our country, both the head of state and the most senior person in the country, were both working women, it's still, there was just still this, like, it was something that had to be fought for. And actually, there was an opportunity for men to be doing lots and lots of good work, but they got a lot of praise for it, while the women just... We took loads more on, but we didn't lose anything.
Yeah.
You picked up loads more balls, but you didn't get to drop the ones that you were already holding.
It's what I mean by the kind of have it all, do it all.
Yeah.
They didn't have it all, they did it all.
Yeah.
You know, my mum would come home from work. Like, we lived in Manchester, in South Manchester, and so she would go into work at Granada in the centre of town, and then she'd come back and, you know, chat to us about our day. She wouldn't normally make it home in time for tea, but she'd be home in time to sort of tuck us in at night, have a chat to us. I grew up with a really strong sense that she was always around.
Yeah.
And what I didn't know until I was in my late teens is that every night she was going back to work after she tucked us in and editing late into the night, you know, doing programmes like World in Action, and using her entire salary to pay for our wonderful childminder who would often stay over. And I just didn't know any of that. She just created this sense that she was always there. And I think for me, like, now being in Parliament and having a little boy
who lives
at the other end of the country, and, you know, I go on about it all the time,
I mean, there is few people, I think you, I and Lucy Powell have the
Lucy
quickest...
Powell messaged me about it this morning, actually. She's raging about a 10 o'clock meeting in half term week in the north of England in London when the trains are up the creek.
Yeah.
And nobody's thought about it.
This is a big quirk that Lisa and I and Lucy often complain about, is that parliamentary recess falls in line only with schools in London. So our children are always off school in a week that we are not off school.
Do you remember that time you brought one of your kids to Downing Street and left him on?
I mean, that's my answer to the childcare crisis. Leave your children on the steps of Downing Street when you and your kids' school is shut. I mean, I shouldn't say that today. I have all the kids.
I was going to say, it's one way of doing it. I mean, I think this is also existential for politics. You know, I look at that and I think this is ridiculous. If you can't have working mums and dads, actually, because I think one of the problems for a lot of dads who are very hands-on is that there's no expectation they're going to be doing childcare at all. But you working mums who live outside of the Westminster bubble, like, you know, we are quite important in politics because we use non-London
the services,
schools, we use non-London healthcare, you know, all that stuff that is really not working at all and hasn't been working for a very long time in most parts of the country. And that part of the country deserves a voice, no?
Yeah.
And if we can't physically get to any of the meetings, then isn't there a problem? But if I could give a shout out to a really good journalist, Sophie Ridge, years and years ago, way before people realised there was a problem in that most people in most parts of the country felt completely written off and written out of our national story, recognised that there was an issue and got out of
Westminster.
She came to do an interview with you. I think you were the first. And then she did one with me the following week. And when she turned up in Wigan, I assumed I was doing the interview down the line. And I thought it's nice of them to let me do it down the line because, no offence to the BBC, but the Andrew Marr show wouldn't let you do it. So they just have a conversation between London-based journalists and London-based politicians pretending it was a national conversation.
Yeah.
And Sophie walked into this working men's club in my constituency and I went, what are you doing here? She's like, well, it's my show. And I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, there's a reason why people read the Manchester Evening News. It's got higher circulation than a lot of national newspapers because it is relevant to people.
I do think that the women are. I noticed Kate McGann yesterday was in Lancashire. I think the women are pretty good. They get that they need to that element of the sort of human going out to where it's actually happening definitely is good.
I think having women in the conversation changes the culture and it changes the tone of the debate. Mm. And, you know, I was really struck during the pandemic. I was doing the shadow foreign secretary job and I was just really struck by the leadership that a lot of women around the world were showing. You know, particularly, I mean, everyone talks about Jacinda Ardern and she's amazing, but, you know, Angela Merkel as well. Yeah. I mean, it was just far more about inviting the public in and saying, look, we're not going to get all of this right because it's unprecedented. And if we get it wrong, we'll change what we're doing and we're listening, but we need you to step up as well. You know, you contrast that with Boris Johnson and Donald Trump and the sort of idiocy that was going on.
Inject bleach into your veins.
Yeah, world-beating health systems.
Oh,
like,
God.
You couldn't beat the rest of the world at defeating COVID. You had to work with them. It was just, what are you talking about?
It's not the Super Bowl.
it's absurd. And, you know, that generation of women leaders, I just really hope that we see a new generation coming through.
Yeah, I think that they, you know, actually that's the thing that comes out off the back of that. But, yeah, I mean, I feel like I wouldn't be here without my mum's activism and my mum's the example that specifically there is something about those sort of late boomer, baby boomer women who, like, you know, born in the sort of late 1940s, early 1950s, they don't get anywhere near enough credit for much better my life is because of them.
I would also say, though, that that's not always true. And one thing that I've definitely felt sometimes is that for that generation of women, there are people who had to fight so hard that they've lost the belief that our generation can do it. And I did definitely feel that a lot in the leadership campaign, that there was a lot of people would say to me, you don't look like a prime minister. They didn't, you know, they meant I didn't have a penis, for a better word. I'm sorry, it was just so obvious. But it was younger women never thought that. They thought I could absolutely do it. But there was a generation that weren't sure at all. You know, they'd say things like, the public won't accept it. But I think, well, I don't think the public are the problem. The public keep electing women prime ministers.
Oh, yeah, the public haven't got a problem with it at all. I've never, ever, ever had... And I've been the only woman on every ballot I've ever stood on. It's never made... It doesn't make the blindest bit of difference to the public, but you definitely... that's the rhetoric that's...
Yeah, and I think for the majority of that generation of women... Like, to have lived through, like your mum, my mum, to have lived through having to fight all those battles and face all those barriers and get no credit at all for busting them down one by one, and then still to be able to turn around to our generation and say, you can absolutely do it. I think that's extraordinary, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard.
Makes me want to raise my game. Yeah. Which is good. Because I probably should.
That's definitely what they'd say.
Yeah.
If they were here.
There they would.
Get the fuck on with it.
Yeah. Stop going on about your letters. Go and fight these battles that you're talking about.
So how would you sign off a letter to your mum? What would you say?
This is really difficult because I don't write letters. So I'm thinking more in terms of WhatsApp. Like, cheers, and can you have my little boy on Saturday?
The answer will be yes. I used to say that about my mother-in-law. I used to be like, I mean, my mother-in-law looks after my kids, but it's hardly a solution for the nation. Like, we do need something slightly better than can rely on my mother-in-law.
Have you just offered out your mother-in-law as the nation's childcare?
I do it with my own kids now. I'm like, my eldest, he can look after the kids if you need it. And he's like, don't do that.
There's a name for that. It's called child labour. And we outlawed it in Victorian times.
He's 18 years old now. He can do it.
But yeah, I mean, just thank you. You know, I don't think anyone thanks that generation enough.
No.
And I think it's important to acknowledge it and to recognise it.
Yeah. So the letter to somebody who's no longer with us, who's that going to be for?
Tessa.
Oh,
yeah. And do you know, it was really weird.
Tessa
as soon as I read what you sent me about who I was meant to be writing letters to, someone who's no longer with us that you'd like to say something to, I just thought of Tessa straight away.
So tell us about...
No, it's all going to get quite sad now, isn't
Tessa.
It?
So Tessa died now... God, it's like... Well, she was diagnosed 5 years ago, I think. Because do you know,
I've completely lost track. I've lost two COVID years,
yeah,
so everything scrambled in my brain.
It was definitely recently. It was the 5-year anniversary of like an amazing speech that she'd made.
So I have this thing when people die, is that I tend to deal with it initially at the outset when it's so, because it's so big, by just pretending it's not happened.
Yeah.
And so there is a very large, I mean, not in a weird way, like, well, I don't bring them up, but like...
Yeah. Disassociation, it's common
but, yeah,
way of coping.
And I sort of still talk to her in my head, so I kind of, yeah. I don't know when it was, I can't remember, and I don't really want to think about it.
So tell us about your relationship with Tessa.
So I didn't know her at all, and I was a new MP, and I was completely at sea. I'd got selected to stand for Parliament about 6 weeks before the general election, and it was fairly unexpected. Lots of MPs stood down at the very last minute. I'd been in Manchester for Tory party conference. I was lobbying them to try and do some decent stuff for refugee kids. And I grew up in Manchester, and I haven't seen Tories out and proud in Manchester for decades. I just thought, oh God, they're going to win. And then my predecessor just announced he was standing down just a few months before the election. He wasn't caught up in the expenses scandal, but I think it had all just created a climate where a lot of people just wanted to get out.
It, yeah.
And so I'd never done anything like that before, put myself forward. I never thought for a minute that I would end up in Parliament. And then 6 weeks later, there I was. And, you know, it's weird when you first get elected because you get an envelope, don't you, handed to you.
Yeah, just handed to you by the... You don't know that that's going
to
happen.
No, and it just says to the Member of Parliament. And I gave it to my predecessor, who was my agent, and said, there you go. And he said, oh, no, it's you now. And so I opened this envelope and it says, please report to Portcullis House with a copy of a utility bill.
Yeah,
and I thought, is that
says,
it? You just take your gas bill?
Come in.
On Tuesday
on
to
Tuesday,
Thursday.
Yeah.
With a gas bill. So I did and said, I think I'm the MP for Wigan. And they said, come in. And so there I am, wondering what to do. And I'm having a coffee with Karen Buck and Tessa comes bowling past. And she'd just been offered a job by George Osborne running the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
So basically they wanted her to come into government and do the Olympic minister job from there. And she said to Karen, I can't possibly do this. I can't go and work for a Tory government. And Karen, you know, pretty forthright, amazing lady, said, no, you can't. And so Tessa being Tessa came up with a really clever plan to basically create a cross-party structure so that she could still run the Olympics but not be working for a Tory government, and did and cajoled everybody into doing everything that she wanted as normal. And a few weeks later, we just had a very quick chat. She'd given me a phone number, told me I must ring her. She'd love to help. And a few weeks later, she rang me and asked me to be a PPS. And I was completely blown away because, you know, cast your mind back to 2010, I was the hard left of the Labour Party. And she was not.
You know, a red Tory, aren't you?
Well, we all are, apparently, now. But there was a, you know, there was... It was really extraordinarily generous. She said, I want you to come in and see how things work. I want, because in the old days when we were in government, you would have sat on the back benches and thrown rocks at us. It would have been frustrating for you and frustrating for us. And if you're going to choose not to be on the front bench, at least know what it is that you're turning down. And so for the next couple of years, I just had an absolute blast. She took me to every single planning meeting and event. It was all about the delivery of the Olympics. You know, in opposition, that's such a gift to get to see how something actually happens. And she was so committed to every part of the country was going to benefit from this and a legacy of sport for young people. And she was one of those people who just wouldn't take no for an answer at all. So even when I completely disagreed with her, and there were so many times when that was the case, she'd say to me, now, darling, but you will be going out and arguing this, you know, you will be going into the tea room and telling people that they need to support this vote. No, I'm not, because I don't agree with you. And she would push me really hard. But when push comes to shove, she always had my back.
She said
she had the worst conversation with a chief whip that she'd ever had in her life about me. And she basically went into bat for me and stuck up for me. And I just, you know, it taught me so much about how you do politics. This, you know, absurd factional wars that Labour got itself into recently, and then the Tories did as well. That's not how you make change. You take people with you, you build broad alliances, you're generous to people and you look after people, and then they do the same for you in return. And I just, I don't know, I miss her a lot.
Somebody once, a journalist once said to me that Tessa was often, even, you know, deserved or not deserved, given a better time in the press than other members of the then Blair and Brown government. because everybody liked her.
She said that to me as well. She said to me once when we were wandering nice through the tea room and she was chatting, you know, asking some of the Tory MPs about their kids. There was nothing calculated about it. She was genuinely interested. But she said to me, you know, it is... Politics is like walking across a tightrope with people throwing rocks at you, and you will fall off at some point. And when you fall, it's going to be brutal, and you need, you're going to need a lot of people rooting for you, not just on your side, but on theirs as well. It's just
it's funny when
advice.
I come across scandal about members of parliament, which obviously we all do all the time. If they are somebody like who has been perfectly pleasant and kind and tried to help you out with getting a bill through or something, like, you know, just been reasonable or given you a fair hearing even about something. Whilst I think that the thing that they've done wrong is still bad and they should be held accountable, I wouldn't ever delight in it or go out of my way to do something, to gloat in the media or something. There is a humanity and everybody is going to fall off at some point.
Yeah, and it's hard because what you can't ever allow that to become is like a cosy club.
No.
So, you know, I'm not going to criticise this person for doing something terrible. I was really struck when I got to Tessa's funeral. She had a big public sort of memorial, but she also had a very small private funeral, and it was I drove there because she lived in a... you know, she spent a lot of time in the constituency. She lived in a really beautiful little village.
Near me?
Is
Warwickshire.
It?
Warwickshire.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so not very easy to get to on public transport. Yeah. So it's from Wigan. So I drove there and it was like a sort of 7 or 8 hour drive. And I thought, what can I do to pass the time? And I thought, I'll download an audio book. And then I had this idea that I would download Tony Blair's autobiography because I thought she'd love that. She'd think I've got you in the end. So I listened to 8 hours of Tony Blair and then I got to the funeral and there he was. And he said to me, can we talk about Brexit? And I was like, I've heard enough from you today. I'm sorry, but 8 hours is enough for anyone. But what struck me about it was that you'd expect all the new Labour crowd to be there. You know, Alistair Campbell played the bagpipes and has never forgiven me for saying it was a racket. But there was... You know, there were lots of other people there as well. There was Andrew Pearce, the journalist, Kay Burley. I didn't know that she was such close friends with Kay Burley.
Yeah, that's what I mean. She was kind to people and she gave people... A fair hearing is fine. You know, a biased hearing is not fine. A fair hearing, and that's... I mean, that's the view that... when I was 16, the new Labour government had just come to power. It was then, it must have been the 50th? Oh, yeah, the 50th anniversary of the NHS existence. And I was working at this big conference for my work experience, my GCSE work experience, that was a celebration. And she was a health minister at the time. And she kept... Obviously, I'm 16 years old, and I was put... with her, like, to take her around to this conference, and we had 50 women who'd worked in the NHS, all born in one of the years of the NHS, etc., that she had to go and meet. And I called her Stella for the entire day. And only...
Why?
I just thought that was her name. I don't know why. Tessa, Stella, it's, like, similar.
It's not similar. It's a completely different name.
And at the very end, it was her and Paul Boateng. I remember it vividly.
What the hell did you call Paul Boateng?
I think I just called him Paul. I think I did get that right. And at the end of the day, she just very politely said to me, I didn't want to upset you, but my name's Tessa. And I was just like, I was so mortified. She was like, I thought if I'd, like, you know, said it in front of anybody. And I was like, I'm
so
sorry.
But this was the thing about her, right, as well, is that she has such a sense of fun and such a sense of mischief. She was always up to something and she was always playing pranks on people. I remember going and meeting some Dutch politicians with her a few years just before about a year before the Olympics was delivered, because I think they were bidding or something, and they wanted some advice from her about how to do it. And she was horrendously late. She was always horrendously late. And she came wandering into the room, darlings, darlings. And then she threw her arms up in the air and started swaying. And you probably can't see this, people listening, but she was literally swaying like a sort of tall tree. And she sort of... did it all the way around the room. Everyone's just sort of sitting there going, what on earth is going on? And she said, tonight I'm going dancing, darling. And it was at her daughter's, a singer, and she's so amazingly proud of her. And she was going watching her sing. And people just, they never really, it was so disarming. People never really knew what to do with her. But I think for me, one of the things about politics and one of the reasons why the public often loathe us is because we seem very robotic, very inhuman. Yeah. And very humourless.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got to have a sense of humour about some of this. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes sort of joke that I'm trying to put the party back in the Labour Party, but, you know, we've got... It has to be fun. There has to be a sense of fun about it all. There has to be a sense of excitement about it. You have to be a normal human being.
Who wants to go along to somewhere who just hectors you all the time?
Yeah, well, it's like we were saying about the Brexit debates,
yeah,
right? Just people shouting at each other. You just turn it off, don't you?
I remember the first time I took my kids to a Labour Party meeting... when they were very little, and I was like, it's the Labour Party. And when we got there and there was no cake and balloons, they were like, that, what is this?
It's not a party, Mum. This is not a party.
You said it was a party. There's no party bags. There's nothing. This is the worst
party ever. But why
not?
That's what we need to bring back. I mean, party bags at every Labour Party meeting.
Considerably better if you've got a goodie bag.
You go home with some streamers and a party popper.
Yeah, that's it. A bit of cake wrapped in...
Yeah, and a plastic car. Yeah. Dinosaur.
That, I'm telling you, that should go in the manifesto.
I think we've revolutionised the whole thing, really.
Oh, you absolutely would if you made it more like a party. It's definitely, it needs to be fun. And Tessa was, slash Della, was beloved by most people, actually. And that's rare, isn't it, to win at politics like that, to leave it beloved. But people like Mo Molan, it's actually the women, isn't it, often? The women
often,
who
yeah.
leave it beloved.
Yeah. One thing I have noticed, though, is that there is a generation of men from that time who are very, very encouraging of our generation as well, of women and men. And it does, you know, you don't have to agree with them all the time, but it does mean a lot to me, actually, that, you know, I can pick up the phone to people like, you know, when I got moved into this job to do Levelling Up, you know, I spoke to people like Jack Straw and John Prescott, spoke to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, you know, people who'd held this brief before. I sent a message to Michael Heseltine and he came back straight away and said, no, I'd be pleased to help. You know, it does make you feel, actually, that there's people... Politics gets such a bad rap.
I know.
But there's people who just genuinely want this country to be better.
When you
and
said
you find
that
them right across the
men from that generation, if you were the MP, Alison McGovern, sitting in front of me, she had the exact same experience that you had with Tessa, with Gordon Brown.
Yeah.
And, like, you know... He.
I can't imagine he was dancing around.
No, I don't know.
Really,
in front
of a load of Dutch politicians.
No, I don't think he danced. But he definitely, like, he found her when she was first elected and sought to propel her. So, what would you? How would you sign off your letter to Tessa?
Oh, I miss you, and thank you. Thank you again. But, you know, I do... the legacy really matters. You know, politics, I'm not moaning. It's the most amazing job in the world. And you get a window onto things you'd never get a window onto. And when you win, it's the best feeling ever.
God. When you have a win, it's better than anything
else. Isn't it? Yeah, it is. And it's worth all of the banging your head against the brick wall repeatedly over and over again to get that. But it's, you know, it can be quite lonely and it can be quite brutal. And you often feel like the ground's shifting beneath your feet.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
No, sometimes you need someone just to say you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Let's go for a drink. And sometimes you need somebody to say, as Tessa once said to me, snap out of it and go and sort yourself out. Complaining, but you've only got yourself to blame.
You know,
sometimes you need all of that.
We're totally fallible.
Yeah.
We're going to mess up.
Yeah. Yeah,
do it
exactly.
All the time.
And just judgment. And, you know, often good political judgment comes from experience and just being able to pick up the phone to somebody who's been there and seen it and done it.
Yeah.
You know, it was, Anyway, it's, you know, it's hard to... I'm trying not to be too miserable about it, but you did ask me about someone who's not here anymore.
She's cheerful.
She was an incredibly cheerful woman. And, you know, that's got to be the legacy, hasn't it? You know, you pick up where they left
cheerful.
Off.
Be more cheerful, yeah. We'll be back for the final letter after a short break.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So the final letter is somebody who wouldn't know the effect that they'd had on your life. So who would that be?
Britney Spears.
Oh, yay! Britney!
Yeah.
I've got a good Britney-related story.
And I am
story.
Deadly serious about this, by the way.
You love
I
Britney
do not
Spears.
Want this to be the jokey, laughy yeah. part of it. I am writing a letter.
This isn't the last question of, like, question time, where you get asked, like, do you like eating Starburst? And it's like, that's, why are we doing this weird aside at the end?
I have a strong view, actually, that the renaming of Opal Fruits was a travesty.
Absolute travesty.
I mean, that is why they ask us these questions, presumably because we have a view on everything.
Yeah.
But no, I am deadly serious about this. I am writing this letter to Britney Spears because I love her.
I think you're right to love her. She's an
excellent
human.
You wrote an article
human.
About her, actually.
Yeah, she's like exactly the same age as me. So she's her birthday is like 3 days before mine.
Really?
So we were born.
And she's although got two boys as well.
She's got two children at the exact same age as my sons, you see. So I feel like...
I feel like you're claiming it here.
No,
I need to wrestle this back.
This
is my letter and my hero.
The song Toxic by Britney Spears,
is the most perfect piece of pop music ever.
There's never been a better song written ever.
Yes.
Ever. That is absolutely 100% the case.
Yeah. I find it weird when people say, what's the best song? I'm like, sorry, have you not been paying attention?
It's obviously Toxic.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I remember when it first came out, I was like, it's like an awakening. It is a perfect pop song. It is an absolute...
But she is responsible for a lot of the most genius pop music. And I think because of people like her, you know what I love about her, right, is that she is talented. Of course, she's extremely talented. But she wasn't... I've read a book. She did this book with her mum years ago when they were still talking. And she said, like, she wasn't always the best singer in the competition. Mm. She wasn't even the best dancer, even though that's, like, really her thing. But she just worked harder because she wanted it more. And I just think there's something so inspiring about that. Like, I'm not saying that I'm now going to announce live on this interview that I'm going to be an international pop superstar with no ability to sing or dance, but... You know,
work harder, Lisa.
This idea that you just pick yourself up and put the hours in and you can do it, I just love it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's like the 10,000 hours thing or whatever it is. But, yeah. Also, I just love that she just went totally off the rails as well. I love everything about Britney Spears' story.
Well, and, like, so when... You know, when I was pregnant with my little boy... Well, actually, it was a few years before that. It was after I got elected to Parliament. I took up playing the piano because I needed something to sort of release the mental pressure. And often, you know, we sit late at night, don't we? And we're all arguing and you get all wound up and then you try and go to sleep and it doesn't work.
You can't get to sleep, yeah.
And so I found myself running around the streets of London at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning because running is a good way to get it out of your system and thinking, I'm going to get killed eventually doing this. This is not a sensible strategy. And so I took up the piano because I thought, I'm not very good at it. I don't have a natural talent for it. And so I'm going to have to concentrate so hard...
That everything else will go away.
Yeah, and it was perfect. And I actually, when I was pregnant with my little boy, I got to grade four.
Wow.
Yeah, and I went and did my grade four exam a month before I had him. And I basically was late and got really stressed out and panicked and then got really hot and sweaty. I had one of those big sweats that you get and ended up crying on a very young examiner who really didn't know what to do with me. And I couldn't even find middle C. And I came out afterwards. It had just been such a bad experience. He was very nice to me. And I cried in the street. And I rang my partner and he said, I think this... Didn't you take this up to, like, release the pressure, not to, like...
ruin
your life. And you're now crying in the street. And so... Anyway, I got the certificate through a few weeks later and he'd passed me, and not just passed me, but passed me quite well. And I really don't think that I earned that pass, but I'll take it in the spirit of Britney Spears, because there I was, 8 months pregnant, and I turned up and I was still trying. Yeah. And I think, well, you should get a certificate for that.
Oh, definitely. People with natural aptitude can piss off. That's much better.
Exactly.
8 months pregnant and giving it a whirl, and you can't even buy middle C in grade four, which is half the way up the grades.
Here's to the triers and the people who give it a whirl, even when there's no obvious reason why they should be giving it a whirl at all. That's what I say.
Yeah, Britney, I mean, she'd been so... like much written about of late because of obviously all the trouble with her family and everything. But I just feel like she sort of like owns herself, and
yeah,
I just really like that about her.
Also recently, all this stuff that's come out, I think it might be a real sort of game changer for a lot of people in that situation in America. I didn't realise the system was
brutal. So weird.
I know, it's unbelievable that they can just sign over your whole life and like your healthcare and everything to somebody else, and then they can take all your money.
My children frequently have in their childhood threatened to emancipate from me. I'm like, you don't live in America. There's not this thing where you can sign.
Yeah, and also, if you emancipate, then I don't pay for you.
I was just like, good luck. Good luck in the future. You're not Macaulay Culkin. You don't have millions. I don't know where you're going to go, but good luck with that. My husband worked on the Upside Did It Again tour with Britney Spears.
No. What?
But... it's not a brilliant story.
It's one of my favourite tours.
Well, I've got the band, I've got the T-shirt, the tour T-shirt. I'll bring it in for you.
I have literally been to every UK tour that Britney's ever done.
So I've got...
I intend to do so until the day I die.
I will bring his local crew Upside Did It Again tour T-shirt for you.
You haven't got one of those red catsuit.
Sadly.
What was it? It was like PVC,
but
wasn't
he
it?
Had to build at Birmingham NEC like a like tunnels so that she didn't see anybody. Like, you know, I don't know whether that's just like the standard.
She's not like people.
She just doesn't like. She didn't want to see a load of rough ass Birmingham local crew.
Well, there was a thing about. Do you know, on that tour, I just remember lots and lots of girls turned up wearing those red PVC catsuits. And then realised about 2 minutes into the concert that they'd made a terrible mistake.
So hot.
Just so hot. And there's nowhere for it to go. Do you know what I mean? It was just... and you sort of look around and think, but you could have thought of this before you did it.
Yeah,
before like, because you're not actually Britney Spears.
Do you think she'll go on tour again here? Again.
I don't know. I mean, you know, that when she did that song with Elton last year, I think it was literally the best thing that happened to me last year. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. And it was a great piece of pop music. So I'm sorry to, like, you've probably got loads of politicos who
No, loads of people have said Taylor Swift, for example.
I just love
a lot of people. There's been a lot of Taylor Swift love. Bjork, people have said, like, I think music matters to people.
I think it does too. Do you remember when if you're about the same age as me, you probably had this as well. But I had a Walkman when I was growing up. This was like a soundtrack to my childhood.
Yeah.
And like when you hear music from that era,
it goes like, it gets you. All right, well, how would you sign off your letter to Britney?
I don't know. It'd have to be like something from one of her tunes, I mean, Oops, I Did It Again is a good one. Maybe One More Time, maybe. I don't know. She's just brilliant. I just basically say to her, I want to be your best friend. Yeah. Please come be my best friend, even though Jess thinks she's got a prior claim on all of this.
Just the same age, same children.
Yeah, and please make some more music, and please go on tour so that we can go.
Yeah, we could go
and watch the gig. Yeah.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much. It's been a total delight, as I thought it would be, and you were actually much better at it than you thought you were going
to
be.
Thanks. Even though you've outed me as being someone that nobody's ever written to in their lives, I'm now going to get stacks and stacks of letters saying I feel sorry for you.
Yeah, you were right, Lisa.
But thank you
a little note.
And I will, given that our offices are only a few doors down from each other, I will come and deliver them to you.
To me. Oh,
as my
great.
Final gift for having me on this amazing show.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you click the follow button now on the app where you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. This has been an Audio Always original.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.